TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hope says that there's somewhere better to go. I feel it negates where we are. It's sort of this thing of it just will happen. Things just will get better. Things get better if we take actions to make them better.
Support for Design Matters Media is provided by Wix.com, which puts the creative power of building dynamic websites back into the hands of designers. As anyone who has spent time in a WYSIWYG platform knows, what you see isn't necessarily always what you get. On the flip side, for some, it's far too easy to get lost in code and lose the forest for the trees. Wix.com allows you to find your own personal sweet spot and take control of your site with their drag-and-drop editor, hundreds of advanced design features such as retina-ready image galleries, custom font sets, HD video, and parallax scrolling effects, and even serverless, hassle-free coding for robust websites and applications. With Wix.com, you have total control of your web design like never before. So join Wix's brilliant community of designers, artists, and creatives at large around the world for free and ask yourself, what will you create today?
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. For 14 years now, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative types about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about. On this podcast, Debbie Millman talks with Jack Ferver about his career in dance theater.
All art is political. It's either waking you up or it's putting you to sleep.
Here's Debbie Millman.
The performance artist and dancer, Jack Ferver, isn't afraid to shock, provoke, or mystify. His work digs deeply into gender, sex, power, and politics. The New Yorker once called his performances so extreme, they sometimes look and feel like exorcisms. So what exactly is Jack Ferver doing? Part ballet, part theater, and all infused with social commentary, Ferver says he sees himself as a mirror, using both humor and darkness to engage with audiences and reflect their emotional and psychological rawness. Ferver is also a professor at Bard College. His work has been performed at the Guggenheim, the New Museum, the Kitchen, and Performance Space New York. He's here today to talk about his work, his life, and his new show, Everything is Imaginable, which just debuted at New York Live Arts. Jack Ferver, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you so much for having me, Debbie. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, I'm happy
it's
you're
so
here
good
too.
To see you,
yes.
Always.
Jack, Out Magazine wrote this about your 2012 show, Two Alike. The show is a psychosexual, semi-autobiographical, choreographic piece that explores the bullying, terrorizing, and abuse Ferver suffered as a child in rural Wisconsin. And Jack, you've said that your main reason for making art is so people don't feel as lonely as you have felt. So please tell us a little bit more about your childhood. I know you described it as boys don't cry, but without the funny parts.
Yeah, that's my one-liner for it. As they said, I grew up in rural Wisconsin, and my parents were older. They weren't anticipating on having another child.
You were a surprise baby.
I was a surprise baby. My sister is 18 years older than me. My brother is 20 years older than me. Even growing up, people thought that my parents were my grandparents. My parents were from Madison, Wisconsin, and they were both very liberal Democrats. My father was a professor at the UW of Madison, Wisconsin. He was 59 when I was born.
How old was your mom?
My mother was 43.
Wow.
So I had these parents who were older, and I didn't have siblings who were in the house, which is one thing. But also, I just right away I wanted to be an actor. We're in this place now which is so amazing that there's so much discourse about trans. When I grew up, there wasn't. And I remember in kindergarten saying I'm half boy, half girl, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. So the bullying started pretty early on. And then it progressed and became more violent by the time I was in high school.
Violent in what way, Jack?
I talked about this in Everything Is Imaginable. There's the example I gave in that was when this kid slammed me into a locker and there was like a piece of metal sticking out of the locker and it cut through my shirt and through my arm and he spit in my face. But stuff like this that's just an example of daily occurrences that were happening.
And the school never intervened, or
it was very just ignore it. And sometimes there'd be maybe an office visit. What it did was I knew that I had to use whatever I had to get out. And for me, I early on was acting. I knew I was good at it. I was told I was good at it. I found out about the arts camp, Interlochen Arts Camp. And I auditioned to go to that, and I got in, and then a teacher there was a professor at Interlochen Arts Academy, and he said, I'll help you get a scholarship to get to the school. And he did. And so I was out by my senior year of high school.
You've noted that the bullying that you experienced allowed you to access your creative self. In what way?
I think when there was so much duress happening in my immediate reality, it forced so much fantasy for me to cope. I had to create alternative spaces with nowhere to go, really, except the woods down by the river. My parents were great about, in one way, would have loved it if they would have gotten me out. In another way, they allowed me to be in productions in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Children's Theater of Madison. And that was where I lived. That was what felt like my real life. And then the life at school and the life in this town, just it felt like a waking nightmare. So it created so much urgency inside of me to develop and nourish this fantasy world, which is what I do now as a job. My parents, but my mother was, I said this at her memorial years ago, she was very good at rearranging reality, which is what I do as a job now.
Lovely, lovely phrase. Now, you being able to get solace from the fictional worlds mm-hmm. that you were creating, you acted out scenes from your favorite films.
All the time.
Yeah. So what kind of fictional worlds were you creating as a kid?
Well, because of where I grew up, I didn't grow up in New York.
You grew up in Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin, which is a town of 4,000 people, and it's 94% white. There's a nearby ammunition plant that has been decommissioned, and a lot of eagles.
Yeah, and I think 4,000 is more. I mean, when I was a kid, I think it was 2,500. There's Prairie du Sac and then Sauk City, and I think together it was around 5,000. And I haven't been back since my mother's death in 2013. So I wasn't, as I said, growing up in New York City with a ballet and theater and all of that. We would go see things at the Civic Center sometimes. But what I had first was film. That was what was – the VCR was relatively new. I think that's actually a big part of my work, that I grew up in the advent of the VCR. So the ability to stop something, rewind, and play it again, I think is very much inside of my theater and choreography. This idea of repetition, cycle loops – so first of all, I remember what is that movie called? The Neverending Story. I loved watching that, and I would watch it over and over and over again. And I would dress up as the Empress with no name because I thought that she could maybe see me. I thought that maybe since this was this story that was unraveling, that maybe they could see me. I mean, I was like 7 or something at that time. And then the big movie for me was Return to Oz.
I know.
Which is inside of that solo that you were talking about earlier, too. Like, Firouza Balk plays Dorothy Gale Post. When she's come home, she can't stop thinking about Oz, so they take her to... They take her to a psych ward for her to receive electroshock therapy. Because I was experiencing abuse and so things were happening, I was exhibiting traits of someone going through trauma, like obsessive compulsive disorder. I was washing my hands. I had an early suicide attempt at 9. And
Jack.
I became the person, I became the, what do we call that in psychology? You're just singled out. You're the issue. You become sort of the object of what's wrong because you're the one who has the symptoms. Mm. But you have the symptoms of what's going on around you. So at the same time, while I was being put into therapy for these events that were outside of my control, that I was displaying symptoms of trauma and duress, I saw Return to Oz, which is all about this girl who's in duress, and instead of anyone listening to her, she gets sent to get electroshock therapy, but instead ends up going back to Oz, where everything is now shattered and in hell. And I would act out scenes from that all the time. I mean, I was obsessed with that. I think that was one of the more positive ways that I coped, was embodying these roles and pretending to be these characters.
You took your first dance class when you were 6 years old.
I can't. It's true. I did tap. Yeah.
And so what made you decide to study dance? Why was that your artistic choice?
Well, I think
at the time,
I think I was dancing around the house anyway because I'd seen Annie. I mean, my sister talks about how they knew I was gay because she came home once and I appeared at the top of the stairs, or I don't, maybe the bottom of the stairs, looking through the banisters, singing "The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow." And I was singing and dancing around the house. I do remember the feeling of seeing Annie. You know, I'd probably sit on my lawn and sing, hoping a producer would come and take me away. So my mom put me in a dance class. And
it seems like a pretty big, bold move for a young boy in a tiny rural town.
Well, as I said, my mom was from Madison. I mean, and they were part of the Unitarian Church there. My parents were so encouraging in this aspect. And then when I was dealing with bullying, they just didn't know how to handle it.
You described your mother as your best friend, and you two would wake up and watch Dynasty together when you were in second grade. And you've said that she wrote down a lot of the things you said as a kid.
She did.
And they're completely in sync with who you are today. So do you remember anything that she wrote down that still applies?
I mean, I remember a couple of them. When she passed, I found she hadn't anticipated having a child. And so it was very special for her. I mean, we were very enmeshed and I was so isolated, and she was this, you know, this friend, which was bizarre because she was my mom, and she would wake me up to watch Dynasty with her. Like, I'd be asleep and my dad was somewhere and she would wake me up and be like, it's time to watch Dynasty, which I'm watching again right now, by the way, as a way
the
to just sort of cope.
The reboot or the old?
No, I don't want to watch the reboot. This is the one I remember the most, so I'll tell this one is, when her mother died, my Nana, I loved so much. I was very close to my Nana. My Nana was incredibly encouraging with me as well. Like, I have photos of, she'd have to be the prince while I would be Snow White and the Evil Queen. She died when I was, I think, 5. And I would draw her face on pieces of paper, and then I'd put them on my face, and I'd lay on the sofa like she was in the coffin. Because I was trying to understand. So I was, you know, acting. And it was driving my mother crazy because she was trying to deal with the death of her mother. So she was on the phone with a friend of hers, and her friend said, well, let me talk to him. And I remember standing on a stool to talk on the phone. That part I remember. I don't remember the rest. But she had it written down that the woman said, you know, your Nana wasn't just your grandmother. It wasn't just your mother's mother. She was also my friend, and we all miss her very much, and we're all together in this, in missing her. And I guess I was so irritated that someone was trying to negotiate my grief in some other way than the way I was dealing with it. And I said, well, I've got news for you, lady. Your friend is dead. And I hung up the phone.
And you're five?
I was five, yeah. So, I mean, there you go. Some people just come right on out.
I got news for you, lady.
And you're really, a friend of mine once said, he said, you didn't have parents. You were found on an endive leave in Versailles and raised by wolves. So I think my personality was pretty formed early on, for sure.
When you were 13, you began classes that embraced the Martha Graham technique of dance. And for those that might not be familiar with that technique, can you tell us a little bit more about that style?
Oh, it's like, it's so intense. Dance, it's so hard to think about how dance and or poetry, where people might not know about it. I mean, Graham changed everything. I wouldn't even say Graham changed dance. I'd say she changed theater. She changed visual art. Her work with Isamu Noguchi, her work with composers like Stravinsky. But anyhow, to break down to where that modality of training comes from, it's based on the contraction, the release. So the contraction through the torso, which includes the pelvic contraction, and to also a release, the release of the torso through not only through the torso, but then up through the back. And to me, where Graham came from, Ruth St. Denis and the Denishon Company, and she was in New York. This is all in Blood Memory, which I read every day from the time I was like, I don't know, 13 to like 18. I would just reread pages of it. The Denishon technique, if you wanted to teach it, you had to pay a fee, and she didn't have that. And so she was in New York. The way I pictured this technique evolving was she would wake up every morning and sit on the floor waiting for something new to come. And I think it happened just from crying. It is contraction and release is, you feel that in crying. It's sexual. It's laughter. It's the ache in memory. It's also, I mean, when I teach, I also look at that at early on, if you're just dealing with confrontation, should you meet someone and come to look at them in their eyes, there's a subtle contraction. You can even feel that. I mean, I don't think a lot of us walk around looking at people in the eyes just feeling really released and open. Maybe people do, and good for them. But I'd say more often than not, there's this slight contraction, maybe even a big contraction we feel. So she developed a whole technique based off of that, which she always said it's contemporary, that she wanted it to be contemporary based. And I was a teenager, and I was in this production of Macbeth. And Lisa Thorell, who'd been part of the Martha Graham Company during the year they had done Panorama, had moved back to Madison, was starting her own company. I was going to be teaching Graham in the school, and she came in to choreograph on The Three Witches. They were all teens. And the first was done, I think, in a more Twyla Tharp landscape. Mine was Graham, and the third one was just crawling. And I fell in love with the technique. I mean, it's a way also of honing energy. If you've ever taken a Kundalini class, there's something akin to waking up this energy that's inside of your pelvis and your chakra, the chakras, and up through the spine, and then moving it out through the distal elements of the hands. It creates a very intense performer, I find. So I wanted to keep doing it.
How did that training influence your work?
Martha was also heavily invested in psychology and creating these works that were about exploring all the facets of the human psyche, of really looking at things that are more dark, hidden. I think of Cave of the Heart when Medea has this solo, and it begins with her just shaking, and then she starts pulling this cord out of her dress, which is like her entrails that she eats and then throws up and eats and throws up. And I mean, that's shocking or if we look at A Night Journey and when that's being done in terms of like the 50s and 60s into Phaedra. I mean, this was to look at the work in terms of that context. I mean, how shocking when the other things you're seeing are more in ballet. So for me, it brought about numerous things. One, a pairing of my psychology with somatics. So this sense of what that contraction is. I mean, that's how I learned to cry on cue, actually. It was not from acting. It was from the Graham technique. Another is ritual. I think that work of of repetition and also of being able to connect to energy is very potent, and theater is a ritual.
You've said that you were drawn to acting and dancing because you can rehearse things over and over and make them right, juxtaposing life itself, which takes place in sort of an out-of-control world where there's evil and bad people. And so is this, do you feel, from a more psychological point of view, trying to rewrite the past?
I mean, I definitely think early on in my childhood that was my draw to it. As I said, I had OCD, so I think obsessive compulsive disorder goes really well with being able to rehearse forever and memorize and go to the same place on stage every night. I think that that's changed for me slightly. My rehearsal process is strong, and it's strong to hold the chaos.
What does that mean?
So in order for there to be chaos, there needs to be a structure that builds around it, because I'm also not interested in dancers getting, or myself, getting injured, which I used to do a lot in my 20s. I mean, for me in my 20s, it really wasn't a show unless I was bleeding. And then that ended for me. It became more about, I remember Mark Swanson, who's a visual artist I've worked with, I remounted a piece that I had originally done at the New Museum, and then I remounted it at Andrew at Lynn Gallery. And I called him after I remounted it, and I said, I never want to do that piece again, and I don't want to do work like that anymore. And he gave me this prompt, which was, you need to find how to scream without screaming, which for me is when I got into more of what I would say emotional formalism, and that's more of what I'm looking at in terms of my work. But that is creating these structures and parameters so that there aren't, I mean, I am injured right now, but that I'm not just doing like Viennese actionism. That there's rehearsal involved in this. And then inside of that rehearsal, someone can fall apart. Then you can corrode inside of the structure that I've made. Then you can corrode inside of that structure because you'll actually feel safe enough to do it.
Well, it sounds like therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's creating a container and a condition. But I found in my viewership of work that I had become less interested in just someone being salacious in front of me or them doing a therapy session on me. Mm. I want people to do therapy in therapy, not on stage. For me, the work is about the audience. And so anything that I'm forming in front of the audience, I've greatly considered. I've worked with my dramaturg. I've dramaturged. And a lot of it isn't even memoir. It's not even true about myself. I'm, as you said earlier, I'm trying to be a mirror. So that requires rehearsal and finding these ways of trying to have with precision, remember, study, and be what people are, which is all things.
You've said that you don't make your work for the dance community or the theater community or for any community. You make your work for everyone. What does that mean, and why is that so important to you, to be able to make work for everyone?
Well, I think people really feel safe in categorical thought. So
what do you mean by that?
So they feel safer if they know that you're Catholic or Jewish. They feel safer if they know that you're gay or straight, if you're a man or a woman. And when those lines start to blur is when we run into tension. I'm creating events that are using theater and dance and performance art and visual art. And I would say my choreography comes out of the syntax of my writing. And my writing is inspired by the dynamics of my choreography. And they each vice grip each other to make these works that I've encountered. And I feel like for me, it comes up if I'm applying for a grant. And then my feedback will be that this wasn't dance enough or this wasn't theater enough. Hmm. And I'm looking to create experiences of catharsis. That's the goal. So these things are all getting used formally. I'm formally using elements of theater and dance, including humor and tragedy. So I'm not invested in making a piece that's for just one community. I'm interested in making work that is for people and ultimately for the people who need it the most. And I think it's something that can happen, especially when we get into more experimental or theoretical work, that some people can feel really excluded from that work. Like if they haven't read Deleuze, they won't get it. And so it's important to me that theoretical element of my work is kept to the process, and I'm not making work that is, look at my theory. Look at my theory in front of me. Yes, I read Pleasure of the Text by Roland Barthes. Like, let's keep that to the making, right? What I've been doing the last few years is, while I'm making a piece, I write alongside of it, which is my theory and my research, so that I can try to make sure that that stays there, so that the performance is a performance. I'm not interested in seeing performances that could be a paper. And I think we know what that is. You see this thing and I think, oh, this is a paper. I don't know why I'm here.
You've taken on an amazingly diverse range of subject matter in your performances. You've reinterpreted the 1982 film Poltergeist.
Yeah.
You've re-envisioned Cleopatra, looking at the parallels between your life and the dancer and the choreographer, Fred Herko.
Yeah.
How do you decide what projects you're going to take on?
I journal. I write. Continually, and it comes up. It brings itself up. Each piece speaks to me, and then it starts to be made. And I test a lot of, not everything sticks. There's things that I'll begin and say, this isn't it, and then it ends. But it might create something to propel to the next. I mean, don't you find as an artist that these things come to you?
I think they come after thinking and sitting and pondering and crying for a long time.
But you see what I mean? It's that emotion has to go somewhere. I think of in that Louise Bourgeois documentary when she says, my body's too small for my emotions. And I'm 5'8". Big emotions. And I feel deeply, I'm heartbroken for the world.
Yeah.
And that, the artist is the stomach of society. We are digesting the indigestible. At this point, actually, I'd say we're the liver.
Absolutely.
You know, we're really in full poison. And that's my job. I view being an artist as a job. My father's father was a Calvinist minister, and I think that all has come through. It's the work. So that's my job. I have to keep going, and I keep looking at things. I think if you're looking at the world and you're an artist, it presents itself. The material presents itself. You look, it comes.
You've said this about your process or methodology. As an artist, my practice is based on the exploration of otherness. My works, while frequently humorous, are built to reflect the psychological toll and distress of xenophobia and displacement. I create by first engaging the psychological concerns of the work, then formally working with raw emotional content to create text, choreography, and direction. What I call the trauma method. Jack, I've never heard of the trauma method before. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, so first, if I'm looking at, and I always am, the work is coming from a psychological standpoint. So there needs to be research there. So I've interviewed therapists who that might be their specialty that I locate and I say, do you mind if I come and talk to you about this subject? Or you look at analysis, you explore all this stuff, you ask questions. I ask questions of analysts or maybe a more psychodynamic therapist, or maybe I need to talk to someone who's actively engaged in politics. So there's that research. And then I look at that through other people's direct, honest experience with it and what I've observed in life. Where that moves from then is me looking at what are a lot of these common denominators, mm-hmm. and then where does that happen through movement? Where does the body take that on? Because trauma goes into the body. Our feelings are physicalized emotions, or maybe it's emotions are physicalized feelings. I can't remember which way that phrase goes.
What I love about how you view yourself in your work is that your personal story isn't that interesting.
Mm-mm.
But what is interesting is what is going on everywhere.
Right.
So given your trauma and your experience with bullying, how are you feeling about the awareness or the semi-awareness that bullying has in our culture now?
We're in a terrible place still. I mean, having the first lady talk about how we shouldn't have bullying online, and yet we have her husband with those tweets. I mean, it's just the thing that is incomprehensible to me is the cruelty to the vulnerable. It's something I simply don't get. And until the most vulnerable of us are free, no one is free. And I find bullying, and it happens everywhere. And I literally see it every day in New York. And I think it would require people having more of a sense of heart. And may that happen. we need the activism to stay strong. I mean, looking at these kids who are leading this movement with the NRA, where are we? Where are the more adults need to be adult? And that is where bullying could potentially start to slow down.
Well, it's outrageous to me that now people, adults, are bullying these kids.
It's as I said,
radio hosts.
It's incomprehensible. It is a pathology. It is pathological. It is sick. That is an illness that has to be addressed. And we have to ask those hosts, what happened to you? Because something did. You know, when you come up against the superego, that is the thing of something must have happened to you. Like when we meet someone cruel, the question is, what happened to you? Because something did. That's if you've gone through trauma, then you either reenact that on people or you become a victim unless you get help. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of people who I think are reenacting the past. They're stuck in that loop. I mean, that is a goal for me inside a performance, that the mirror can be strong enough that it wakes them up. All art is political. It's either waking you up or it's putting you to sleep.
Beautifully, beautifully said, Jack. You have said that performance is about catharsis, but that catharsis doesn't happen in rehearsal. It happens with the audience.
Yeah.
So how does that happen?
In dance and more experimental performance, you generally have four nights, which in a theater, that'd be your previews. I mean, your previews are generally a couple weeks, and then you open. In dance and experimental theater and performance, you have these four, maybe five nights, and then it's gone. I mean, it's just beyond devastating. Each show gets harder on me. Each show, when it ends that short after I've spent a year and a half on it, or to 2 years, feels like the Olympics or something. So the audience is the final collaborator, and the show changes with the audience. It's another reason I wish I had longer runs, because I get all this information on opening night that then I change the next night, because the audience, I can feel them. I feel their feelings. I feel, which are multivalent. They're not all just one feeling. And that creates this other dialogue. And that is where the catharsis happens. It's between the performance and the audience. I mean, in therapy, you have the therapist, you have the client, and then the healing in a way happens somewhere in between there. It's sort of, it happens on an angle. And what I'm creating. Maybe eventually I'll be a psychoanalyst and I'll just do my audience one at a time.
Claudia LaRocco of The New York Times wrote this about you. With his mad blue Betty Davis eyes and penchant for public suffering, he is good at making a spectacle of himself and, more to the point, he excels at making his audiences deeply uncomfortable. Why make your audience uncomfortable?
I think the discomfort comes out of seeing oneself and seeing the things that one doesn't want to see, that we turn away from. In terms of Graham, it's I'm not showing things how people want them to be. I'm showing them as they are. And that is uncomfortable. I mean, it's when we think about what we go through in a day and the things we might try to shut down, lock away, those are ghosts. Those haunt us. And that's where the exorcism of my work comes about, or the sense of that they're all coming out, they're spilling out, they're everywhere. And that's uncomfortable. The work that I've most loved, from film to literature to performance, does make me feel uncomfortable. And part of it is also that I don't know where it's going. Again, back to categorical thought, I think people really want, they can frequently feel good if they have a sense of where it's going, because that creates a form of sedation. And when we're living in such high stakes, people maybe want to just put something on that's so super familiar that they can feel. I mean, I'm rewatching Dynasty. Like I'm rewatching it. So I think that's where the discomfort comes from. It's me not shying away from things as they are.
You have some provocative opinions and thoughts about hope.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, I find that Hope says that there's somewhere better to go. I feel it negates where we are. It's sort of this thing of, it just will happen. Things just will get better. Things get better if we take actions to make them better. And it requires being active. They don't just magically change.
I do find that people wait for change to happen.
Unfortunately. And I'm someone who's done that. And so I can speak to that it doesn't.
I have too.
Yeah. But I do have faith. But my faith is that things change.
So that your action will manifest in
some
results.
If you take an action, something happens. If you try to help, something happens.
What about your teaching? Do you feel that teaching forces you to be hopeful or optimistic?
It's not even optimism. It's my belief that I am so excited about the younger generation.
It's gotten really exciting lately, right? Well, we've passed the baton.
Well,
the baton has been passed.
We looked at where the voting was for the election, and you looked at how their age range voted. Come on. I mean, that is, they are pushing to have this discourse. I mean, it's what I said earlier about the kids who are leading this movement with the NRA. I don't think it's hope as much as it is a sense of, again, faith that the nature of things is to change and fall apart and turn to something else. And so my job is to be the adult there. That's what I'm doing there. I'm trying to create the best environment and the best container for them so that they can lead, because I'm not going to be here forever.
Well, let's talk about your most recent work. You had an extraordinary show at New York Live Arts titled Everything is Imaginable. The New York Times described it as a dance fantasia with a quartet of prominent male artists from different corners of dance to join in exploring their queer identities. Drawing from their childhoods, Mr. Fervor has devised a solo for each. The mix of styles and personalities offers an intimate and intriguing look at the intersection of dance and sexuality. Congratulations on sold-out run. Congratulations on the numerous pieces in the New York Times, the extraordinary collaboration you did with them on Instagram, which is something people can go and look at. How did you come up with the concept for the show?
So this piece began, I just finished doing a work called I Want You to Want Me. And my close collaborator, who I've known since we met at Interlochen, Reed Bartlemy, he found out that he had cancer while we were making that work. And the work became, I was taking inspiration from Suspiria and this idea of gothic qualities and vampirism, and it was funny, but it was so wrapped up in death. And I was interested in looking at what it would be to be with friends I didn't have and to create conditions of play. And so I began that process in August of 2016. And then the election happened. And then my father died. And everything I made, pretty much everything I had made up until that point, had to go. It just didn't make sense anymore. My context had changed. My original questions to them had been there, which was, in the absence of any queer icons for us as kids in the 80s, who did you love? Like, who was your icon? And I didn't give a parameter for childhood. I just said that. So they all chose different things. So James chose Judy Garland. Lloyd said Martha Graham. Garen Scribner said Brian Boitano. Reed said My Little Pony. And mine is Michelle Pfeiffer's Selena Kyle Catwoman. And so I made solos for the four men who were in this piece, which, when I then put them together, realized came out of a historical chronology for myself, a first musical theater for Judy, Martha Graham. Brian Boitano was looking at ice skating routines and then trying to abstract them onto the stage. So that's coming more into my more later adult work. And then Reed's material really comes out of my own choreographic process that is coming out of psychological gesture, I would say. And then the Catwoman piece was coming out of both psychological gesture and my use of abstracting film into choreography. And then after the solos, there was this quartet I had made early on that I decided to keep. But I also decided to, and the reason I had cast Garen in it was I used to be in it. And then I wanted to cut myself out.
Why?
Because I felt so isolated that I had to actually comment on my lack of friends growing up, instead of just creating a condition of, oh, here I am playing with friends that I wish I would have had. It just didn't make sense. It wasn't true. So I had to just make two acts. So the first act were these solos and then this quartet. And then in that quartet, James and Reed are doing this pas de deux I made that comes more out of my queer Balanchine. And Lloyd and Garen are in this sort of Martha Graham sex duet upstage. And then it ends and the curtain closes. Jeremy Jacobs' incredible set, this gay pink abstraction of Ballet Flats, gets taken away. We're just in this black box stage with a smaller set. I mean, it's the model of the set upstage that I'm now interfacing with. As a way of almost, I took the whole show and it like was just in my mind and it was back there and I'm alone. And then I talk some. I tell the story about having torn my calf a couple weeks prior to the show and what that brought up for me. And it just starts to shatter. It starts to corrode. And the prompt for my part came from my dramaturg, which was, he said, well, what does Catwoman do in Batman Returns? She comes home to her pink apartment. She spray paints everything black and destroys it. So that's what I do in Act Two. The Reed comes in and we do have this moment, which is about who is that friend who you've known forever and what are the tensions that exist in friendship. I want to even look at the taboo. I think it's very taboo to talk about, you know, in relationships, we're like, oh, relationships, they go through their highs and lows. Sometimes you don't, you know, you're mad at your partner, da-da-da. People don't want to talk about that with friends. In friends, I found that to be even more devastating. It's the friends and the what's happening in the friendships that can haunt me at 2 a.m. And so Reed and I have this duet that's about that. And my experience of post-election, friends getting, we all became so tired. I felt like people almost became more isolated in some ways. We come together for these rallies and then need to recharge alone somehow, or friends' interests changed and, you know, people go in these different ways. What was that? And the shattering effects of all of this, the queer eye is a shattered eye. It just breaks apart and then it turns into something else in front of whoever it's in front of. So that's all these solos came out of my body. I make all the choreography of the dancers. Of course, I was with these incredible dancers who can definitely get their leg higher than me. But it all came out of my body. So it was about how did these, what's this lineage? What are these solos? And that this is all of this inside of the queer kaleidoscope coming out of trauma and play. And I also would say in terms of play and humor in my work, which my work is also very funny.
But cheeky. It's very witty.
Yeah, and it comes out of a self-awareness, which I think a lot of people have. That's something I do think we're at now. I feel that there's more self-awareness these days than maybe like 20 years ago. So that's where the work, that's how the genesis of it happened and unfolded really over a year.
Why the title Everything is Imaginable?
Well, it first began, my titles always come first. And it was this thing of, what did you imagine as a child and can I create that for you now? So if James was obsessed with Judy Garland, how could I give him the best Judy Garland solo possible? The other thing that I wanted to say inside of that title is everything is imaginable, including the unimaginable, including losing your mind. The shattering effects I felt post-election of feeling all of my trauma come on to me in a hyper-physicalized way that I had not experienced since leaving there was surreal. I couldn't have imagined that.
What do you do with dance and movement that you can't do with words?
The body shows us everything. I mean, one of the first things I do with students is comes out of right out of Graham. I have them walk across the floor with their right arm over their head and say their name. And I get so much information just from that.
Like what? Like what?
Where they're afraid.
Where you can tell.
Where they're open. Mm-hmm. What it is if like the hips have mobility to them. What if the hips are locked? You know, are the shoulders forward or are they on the back?
I love that you can notice all of that.
I spend lots of time watching people. I had a full anatomy training, so I knew where all the bones and muscles were, where all of that comes from. The psoas, this deep muscle in your body. I mean, that muscle flexes if you were to hear an explosion before you even hear that explosion. That's your panic muscle. And interestingly enough, that activates in a contraction. So, I mean, I could talk forever about where dance comes in to play inside of this. It's it picks up what I can't talk about. For me, I mean, I'm also trying to make work in a, and I believe in making work in a post-conceptual way, that it's coming from feelings and inspiration, and I create all this material and then I need to be formal with it so that it can be viewed. And then also creating mystery.
You are a true polymath, Jack Ferber. Not only are you a dancer, performer, writer, professor, you're also a podcast host.
Thanks to Reed Bartlemy. We have a podcast.
So it's called Dance and Stuff.
It's called What's Going On with Dance and Stuff.
What's going on with Dance and Stuff?
Because when we came up with it, we thought, well, what's going on with Dance and Stuff? Because when you start talking about it, it's truly what's going on with dance and stuff. I mean, as we just experienced when you asked, well, what's, you know, where does dance come in, where language runs out? It's a hard subject to talk about.
You've done 50 episodes. Congratulations.
We're coming up on our 50th episode. We frequently just talk about anything. We review movies a lot. And then we get to have guests on who people might not know about. I feel like dance and poetry are pretty, they don't get a lot of airtime, right? So it was important to me for the field. And we also certainly have performance makers on, and I want to have more experimental theater makers on so that we can give a platform for these people who are the avant-garde.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is what you're working on next.
I know what it is. Yeah, title came first, Love, Mom. So Love, comma, Mom. I'm looking at romance and motherhood, specifically through Golden Age Hollywood. The main movie I've been looking at is now Voyager. And I'm working on it with the actor Christian Coulson. And I'm looking at archetypal scenes that are romantic. So, of course, I mean, I have to – North by Northwest with the scene in the woods. And, I mean, we're looking through all of these. And so – I'm aggregating them and creating them as a score. And so the first half of it will be about romance and love, and the second half will be about motherhood. And where and how do we not let mothers have both? I want to look at it, as well as, of course, there's this valence of we don't see the queer body in these experiences.
Jack, thank you so much for being on Design Matters today. Thank you for making the world just a more artistic and authentic and an honest place with everything that you're doing.
Debbie, thank you so much. I'm so grateful that you invited me to be on today. Thank you.
If you are interested in finding out more about Jack Ferber, which you should absolutely do, head on over to his website, jackferber.org. This is the 14th year I've been doing Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
For more information about Design Matters or to subscribe to our newsletter, go to debbiemillman.com. If you love this podcast, please consider contributing to our new Drip Kickstarter community. Members get early access to the podcast, transcripts of every interview, invitations to live interviews, Q&A sessions with guests, and a brand new annual magazine. You can learn more about this at d.rip/Debbie-Millman. That's d.rip/Debbie-Millman. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review in the iTunes store and link to the podcast on social media. Design Matters is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com and recorded live at the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program in New York City. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland. Generous support for Design Matters Media is provided by Wix.com.